Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Chav Bet Amud Bet on the last line. Rav Yosef Havelu Hanu Tale. Rav Yosef had these trees. Rashi says they were palm trees because later on the sugya is going to speak about tamarim, the dates are on the trees. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Gershom used a more generic term of ilanot bachurim, that these were young, well-developed trees or fruit trees of some sort. The Havu Ate Umne, there were blood letters that were coming, v'yatve tutayu, and were sitting under the shade of these trees. In order to perform their services for their customers, they were bloodletting under these trees. The Balei Tosafot over here note that it's Bekarka Shalahem, that it's in their own property. This was not Rav Yosef's property upon which they were sitting, but his trees cast shade upon their property. And they were sitting on their property and bloodletting over there. Because otherwise, we'll see later on in the Sugya, you would consider it to be direct Nezek if they're actually entering into Rav Yosef's property. Vate Orve, and then these ravens came. It seems that the ravens are coming because of the availability of blood or the blood that is being spilled over there from the work that they are doing. Achle dama, they were drinking or eating the blood that was there. Vesalke abeitale, and then they went to perch up on the trees above. Umafsade tamare, and they were ruining the fruits up above. Amarle Rav Yosef, Rav Yosef says to the blood letters that are over, Ishamash or whoever's there with him, Afikuli korkor mehocha. Get rid of these ravens from here. And the way that's going to happen is by you stopping to doing the bloodletting over here. The lashon of korkor, as Rashi notes over here, is the sound that the ravens make. Or in essence, it's a anamanatapia, where the word is the sound of what you're trying to simulate. And so korkor is the squawking sound that the ravens make. And he says, get rid of the ravens from here. Based on this, later on, the Balei Tosafot prove that the issue that Rav Yosef had over here was not necessarily with the blood letters in the blood below, but rather with the ravens themselves. And he writes over here, "Badai im lo ayu orvim, if there were no ravens over there, hayusovel af agav danina date, that he would have suffered that, even though he was not so comfortable with the blood and that he was a very squeamish type of individual. But it was the ravens that were causing the problem. Or the fact that the orvim were eating the blood and then depositing it on the fruit. So it was the orvim that were the major issue over here. They were what were causing the problem. And therefore, Rav Yosef believed if you got rid of the ravens, he would live whatever was going on. So I'm like, Abayi's Talmud says to him, Vagramahu. Is it only grama? They're not doing anything that's causing direct damage to you. And this is where the Balei Tosafot prove that it has to be on their own land and not in Rav Yosef's land. And when it comes to Groma ben Ezekiel, that is Patur. Amalei Hachi Amai Rav Tubi Bar Matno. This is what we saw at the end of yesterday's daf. The Rav Tubi Bar Matno says, Zotomeret, Groma ben Ezekiel Nasur. What we learned about our Mishnah tells us that Groma ben Ezekiel, even though it may be Patur, it is still Asur. And since it's Asur, I can demand from them that they remove themselves from here. And then Abaye poses another question. Him, Vahach Ziknohu. Don't they already have a chazaka here to do this? They've been doing this here for years, and they've established themselves here. How can you now all of a sudden ask them to leave? Hamar Rav Nachman, Amar Rav Avua, ain't chazaka than a zikin. So Rav Yosef responds to Abaye and says, that doesn't help over here, because with regards to normal cases, you can establish a chazaka over time through utility or through usage or easement. But over here, when it comes to damage that is being done, you cannot establish a chazaka vis-a-vis nizikin. Now, what's interesting about that is the Balei Tosafot here quote from the Rabbeinu Tam. And he says, filu hikne, that not only is a chazaka not work over here with regards to establishing your presence and causing damage to someone else, even if you have a formal kinyan, you have a transaction between you with an agreement that the party can do this, he can walk away from that agreement and say, it was bitaut, it was a mistake, and it was underlying understanding here was mistaken because I thought I could handle this damage, and now I see I can't handle it, and he can walk away from it. The Balei Tosafot themselves reject that and say, the only thing said by the Gemara is, ein chazaka l'nizikin. There's no chazaka that you can establish by nizakin, but then it shows that you can have a ra'aya, a proof would work by nizakin, and a proof would obviously be a full-fledged kinyan. Over here, the Rishonim, based on that answer of Tosafot, are split as to whether, when we say the Yesh Raya means a formal kinyan, and Mechila would work over here, Or only a formal kinyan would work over here, but mechila would not suffice over here. So the view of the Ramban is that formal kinyan works, mechila does not. The Rambam, on the other hand, believes that both formal kinyan and mechila are all vehicles for establishing a presence, even though there's nezek. The only thing that doesn't work is chazaka. Then Abayis says back to him, didn't we qualify that when we say in chazaka l'nezikin, that Rav Mari Amar Bekutra, that's only true by smoke, Rav Zvid Amar Bebeta Kisei, that's only true by an outhouse, by a bathroom. So over here, Rashi says that the Ashan is coming from whatever source that is there. The other hand, Balei Tosafot say that the Kutra near the Ri, the Dafa Bekutra de Kibshan, it's talking about a big furnace that puts out a large amount of smoke, Shugadol Mazik Bioter. That's when the problem exists. And that's when you can say that there's Ein Chazaka L'Nizikin. The other hand, Rashi does not have that qualification about the Ashan. The other hand, by Beit Kisei, Rashi says, Shagave Akarka. They were above ground bathrooms, and Tosafot seconds that, again, saying that that is an extreme form of damage or discomfort that is caused to the individual because it's an overpowering odor or smell that emanates from it. But on the other hand, the Balei Tosafot say, like our bathrooms, which are below ground and are covered, where the smell is more contained, over there you could have a chazaka l'nizakin. The way Tosafot says it, and Rashi seemingly is saying something of a similar nature, is that the type of damage has to be this extreme form of damage, which it's untenable for a person to live with this, whether it's the odor or whether it's the smoke, and that's why those cannot establish a chazaka. But lesser forms of damage, or have saved mamon even losses of money, you can't establish a chazaka. On the other hand, there are rishonim who focus on the persistence of the problem rather than the overwhelming nature of the problem. Tosfot again here talks about a lot of smoke and a tremendous odor. On the other hand, there are rishonim who focus on the persistency. If the smoke is there all the time, or if the smell is persistently there, then that is the problem. So it has to do more with the persistence rather than the quantity of the item that is there. So if that's the case, they could establish a chazaka over here. So Yosef responds to Abayin and says, Hani l'didei danina da'atai. I am a squeamish type of person. And so for me, this type of thing is just like kikutra beta kisei damuli. It's similar to the smoke or to the beta kisei. And from this, the Balei Tosafot note that when Rav Yosef wanted to get rid of the orvim, it must be because they were doing something by depositing blood on the items themselves and not eating the fruits or doing other damage to the fruits. Because as far as Hefsed Mamon, there is a chazaka for Nezakim, according to our Gemara here. It's only in these more extreme forms of Nezek where we say it doesn't work. Therefore, you'd have to believe that the problem that the Orvim were creating was by taking the blood and then depositing it on the fruits. And that was something that disgusted Rav Yosef so much so that it was similar to the smoke and the Beta Kisei. And that might exactly be the reason why there is no chazaka over here. Because generally the way that a chazaka is established is if nobody rejects this type of behavior over a period of time. And so therefore, when you have certain items that are so extreme in their nature, it's obvious. It's an unspoken rejection of this behavior. The individual thinks that I don't even have to say anything. It's so migu'al and so problematic that I don't have to say anything because it's self-evident that this is problematic. And therefore, the chazaka doesn't exist because it's as if he's mochet. It's as if he rejected this type of behavior. The reason he didn't say anything is waiting for the right moment to tell him to get out of here. But aside from that, we would assume that there is a rejection of this type of behavior. And based on this, Tosfot also adds an additional aspect here, which is the fact that generally when it comes to a chazaka, you need a ta'ana along with the chazaka. We'll see that later on in the Gemara. That whenever you want to make a claim, you have to say you bought it, you inherited it, and only through that can your chazaka help you. But if you simply say, I've been here for 3 years, that doesn't help. Over here, the Balei Tosafot suggests it's different when it comes to utility easement or usage rights, where you say that I've been doing this near my property, on my property for 3 years, and even though it's affected your fruits, you didn't say anything. From there, you see that he could establish a chazaka without saying that he actually purchased it from Rav Yosef. Although other Rishonim reject this view that is brought by the Reed Bar Mordechai in the Balei Tosafot and suggest that even in situations where you have utility or usage that's causing bigrama, nezek, to your neighbor, there still you would require some sort of ta'ana as to how you acquired it. b'tashmish ba'alma shenehenen mimenu. That tashmish ba'alma would also require a ta'ana, not simply a chazaka. Okay, now we move on to the next Mishnah, which is marchukim et shovach min ha'ir. 50 amot. Individual has to distance the shovach from the city 50 amot. Rashi says here because they're mafsidin zarenei ginot, that they ruin the seeds that are in the gardens. Whether that means the seeds that are planted in the gardens or whether it's the seeds growing in the gardens, Rashi says that's the problem. On the other hand, the Balei Tosafot suggests that the problem here is that people dry their produce on the roofs in the city, and if you have the birds that are coming in, they're going to eat the produce that is sitting on the roofs of the houses of the city. But it can't be talking about the sadot. Can't be talking about the fields, because the fields are far away from the city. I mean, the city is there, and then you have a requirement to distance the fields at least 1,000 amot away from the city based on the rules of the Torah. And so therefore, we're not talking about the fields, but rather about the city itself. And therefore, Tosafot focuses on the tvuah that is being dried out by the people. Person should not establish a dovecote or birdhouse within his property, unless he has 50 amot in every direction, by which ensuring that these birds won't, according to Rashi, damage the adjacent fields, or maybe according to Tosafot, depending where this location is, it won't affect the people in the city who are drying out their grains. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Beit Arba'at Kurim, Melo Shigar Hayuna. On the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda says it has to be at least 4 kur, a square area of 4 kurim, which some mention as being 3,000 by 3,000 amot, the amount of distance that a bird normally flies, and therefore you have to give yourself that amount of distance in order to protect the other people's property. Vim lacho, if he purchases it that way, afilu beit rova haru b'chezkato. If he purchases it with the item already in existence, then even if there's a small area of a rova kav around it, then it comes with all those rights that are associated with it. The way the Rabbeinu Gershom explains it is that im lacho shnai me'achad, two people purchase property from a single individual, by which he now split the property, and one of them got the bird's nest or dovecote on his property, and it's immediately adjacent to the other property that was sold, the sadeh, then the individual who bought it with the dovecote or the bird nest on it gets those rights, because that's how it existed before, and he bought those rights when he bought the property. Or you could say that this person before him had already come first and established their chazaka then, and if it's sold to him with those rights that already exist, and since he already has those established rights, he doesn't have to then worry about what will happen or won't happen, because those rights were sold to him by the previous owner of the property. So Mary wants to understand, Chamishim ama betulo. Is it true that 50 amot will suffice over here to ensure that these birds don't do any damage? Why is there a number of 50 amot? Remini, didn't we already learn, in porsim nishbin leonim, you can't put up traps or nets for the birds. Elim kein rachok min ha'yishuv 30 ris. Unless you're at least a minimum of 30 ris away from any settled or inhabited area. Now, 30 ris, we actually saw this before in the Gemara, is the equivalent, as Rashi says, of 4 mil. Or in essence, every 7.5 ris is equal to 1 mil. And the Balei Tosafot, when we saw this before, noted that the word ris might have actually originally been ros, resh vav samich, because the gematria of ros is 266 amot, and that is basically 1 out of 7.5 of a mil, because a mil is 2,000 amot. So then 266 divided by 2,000 is roughly 7.5 times, and that would give you that every 7.5 ris is equal to a mil. But that's 4 mil, not 50 amot. So I'm Rabbi, Mishat Shaiti Tuva. The truth is that they fly longer distances. They can actually cover larger swaths of area, and therefore putting up the traps is problematic even further out. But Karsayu b'chamishim amto malyo. On the other hand, their bellies are filled within 50 amot. So then the damage they're going to do to the crops or people's fields is limited to the 50 amot, because by the time they get to the 50 amot, they're not going to be eating anymore. On the other hand, in terms of flying longer distances, then that causes problems in terms of capturing those birds, because you can assume that the birds are owned by parties or people when you're trapping them within the 30 ris of the city. Gemara says, Va'atanyo, when it comes to b'yishuv afilu mea mil lo yifros, so you're telling me that over here, that there's only a limit of 30 reis. And once you pass that threshold, you can put up traps outside the city. Don't we have a brighter that tells us when we're talking about inhabited or places that are residential, then you need to leave at least 100 mil. So Rabbi Yosef Amar, you misunderstood what the word yeshuv meant. We thought originally the word yeshuv meant the same thing that it meant before, which means a city or an inhabited area. And then the Baalei Tosafot over there then start to wonder what exactly the Gemara was thinking about. Do they take the mea mil literally? Or we're just saying mea mil means any amount of distance. If it means any amount of distance, then you wouldn't ever be able to put up a trap at all because of the fact that everything is 1,000 mil from an inhabited area, even in the Midbar. So you have to assume that the mea mil that they're speaking about here is actually literally 100 mil. But even within 100 mil, you'll still have a problem with this brayta and explaining everything we've said until now. So therefore, the Ritzbah suggests over here that Salkadatra de Ari Bishub Zraim. That what we think about originally is when it says yeshuv, it means a yeshuv which is sadot, full of grains. And over there, it seems that they would go unlimited distances, and that would be a problem for our Mishnah that says that it was 50 amot. And therefore, Tosfot says that the question of the Gemara, based on the fact that it started with yeshuv zraim, which would be problematic for what we said until now in our Mishnah, because there we were speaking about issues of zraim, and moving it over to the other definitions of the word yeshuv, solves the problem and avoids the stira with the Mishnah. So the Gemara then answers, you got the meaning of the word yeshuv wrong, and therefore Rav Yosef Amar b'yeshuv kramim. We're talking about a bunch of vineyards, and it's an area covered in vineyards. Rav Amar b'yeshuv shuvchim. Rav says that it's a area where there's a chain of dovecotes or birdhouses, and therefore these birds make it longer distances because they have rest stops or places along the way in which they can refuel, and therefore keep going further. So had it been just one dovecote or one bird's nest, they would have stayed there and only gone or flown for a certain distance. But now that you have a chain of them, or a chain of vineyards, which gives them the ability to eat and to feel comfortable jumping and keeping going forward, they will go then even further distances. Mar says, "V'tipikulei mishum shovchim gufayhu." So now, if you tell me the problem with trapping these birds is because we're afraid they came from people that own them, then if you tell me that it's a chain of birdhouses or dovecotes, then why don't we worry about the fact that you're actually stealing from the individuals whose birdhouses or dovecotes that they are, rather than worrying about the fact that it might have come from an area so far away where somebody owned it? It says, some suggest that the interim birdhouses or chains of dovecotes belong to him. So therefore, there's no problem of stealing from them. The question is, if these birds originated from somewhere else and then jumped from one of his dovecotes to another dovecote, some say that it belonged to a Kna'ani, and even though we have a machloket in the Gemara Baba Kama as to whether Gezel HaKna'ani is mutar or asur, and we generally postulate that Gezel HaKna'ani is asur, over here, this is not outright Gezel. Even for Jews, it's not considered to be outright Gezel, it's a takanat chachamim. And therefore, the chachamim only instituted that takana for Jews, because it's basically a social contract that we will not steal in this manner. And therefore, the Kna'ani is accepted from this rule. That these are dovecotes or birds' nests that are not owned by anybody. And therefore, the interim jumps, we don't worry about where they landed. We only worry about the origination or the origins of this bird, which might have come from the city. Or, according to the way Tosfos learning from this Yishuv Zraim, and since they can jump, they can go much further distances. And therefore, you can't set up your traps even within 100 mil because they have this ability to travel those longer distances. From this, you would conclude that we will speak up on behalf of a purchaser and we will speak up on behalf of an inheritor. So now, the way that Rashi learns this is that if a person comes along and says that I inherited this from my father, and he can show us evidence of the fact that his father was there from 3 years. Or the person comes along and says, I purchased this from so-and-so, and he has evidence of the fact that that so-and-so he purchased it from owned it for 3 years beforehand. So the prior party had a chazaka on it, and now the individual says, I inherited it, or the other individual says, I purchased it. But on the other side, the claimant is coming and saying, wait a minute, that was my property. And he brings evidence of the fact that it was once his property. So now, what does the buyer or the Yoresh have a claim against this individual? He says, it was my property. Your father lived there for 3 years, or the person who sold it, you lived there for 3 years, they stole it from me. Who says they bought it? And that's what the Gemara is saying over here. Toanim l'lokeach v'toanim l'yorish. For that yorish, we say that, even though he doesn't say it, we say that his father purchased it from this individual or from this individual's father. And that's why his father was there. And that's why he's inheriting it. Or on the other case of lokeach, the buyer says the seller was there for 3 years and he has evidence of that. We, on behalf of the buyer, say that the seller must have purchased it from you or from your father's. And that's why, even though you have evidence that it was once yours, the interim parties bought it from you. And we do that on behalf of these individuals. So Gemara says, what's the chiddush of Rapapa over here? Tanina, it's an explicit Mishnah. Haba mishum Yerusha, person who comes from Yerusha, inu tzarich tana. He needs no other claim. He just has to prove that he's a Yoresh, and that his forefathers were there for 3 years, and that's it. He doesn't need any other claim. Gemara says, lokeach, it's trichile. We need a lokeach. That's the chiddush that he's teaching us. Gemara says, lokeach nami tanina. That's also an explicit Mishnah. Lakach chatzer. He purchases a chatzer bazizim v'guzdarot. And he has these projectiles or ends of beams that extend out from the chatzer into Rushut Abim. Harizo b'chezkata. Since it's already there, he has a chazaka, that is the case. So now, tzricha. Gemara says, now we need it. Because the yashmin and hotam gabi Rushut Abim. Over there, that Mishnah is speaking about in the public domain. Imor kones letoch shelohu. You'll say the reason that we allow him to keep it or establish the chazaka is because he backed into his own property in order to put those there. And that's why he has a chazaka. Or maybe the public gave him that right or easement to put those there. In our case, where we're speaking about a yachid, lo, maybe that would not be the case. If you only told me about the case here, let us say that he placated the other party and got the rights to boot whatever he did over here, inami achuli achel gabei, or the other party forgave him and gave him those rights, of Rabim, mayin pais, or mayin shavik. Who is the one that he can placate? Rashi says there's no recipient on the other end, or there's nobody who can really forgive. The Rabbeinu Gershom says that it's just too much money. Who is he going to pay? He has to pay everybody in the city. It's not doable. The Baalei Tosafot do say that there is an ability to transact or have the Rabim be represented by what's called Shiva Tuveir, by Mamad Anshayir, which is the seven representatives of the city who are appointed as the council of the city in the presence of the city could make a deal like this. But again, it would be very hard to get all of that together. And therefore, by the Rabim, Eimalo, we would say no, Tzricha. Therefore, we need both what we establish from our Mishnah as well as what we establish from the other Mishnayot. So, Eino Chanami, in terms of Yoresh, we only have the other Mishnah. The Baalei Tosafot will point out that we'll extrapolate from here. Here, where we have our Mishnah talking about a Yachid, and that's what Rapapa is indicating to us, and we have the Mishnah by Rabim, now we know it applies to Yachid v'Rabim. The same will be true by a Yoresh, that he will inherit the right, whether from a Yachid or from the Rabim. So we will apply what we know here by Lokeach to Yoresh. But the Chiddush that Rapapa is teaching us is that our Mishnah, which allows you to have garner rights, when it says that if you are by it in this way, that the right is already established, so you see that we're to'ain on his behalf, that the party who sold him this item had the right beforehand, and he is able to continue with that right. So that is a din in the yachid. So the chiddush that we're saying is that even though he is a lokeach yachid, and you might have thought you can't extrapolate that to Rabim, or had you not had this mission and only had the mission of Rabim, you wouldn't extrapolate to here. That's what Rapapa comes to teach us, that they are both true, and both of them can establish chazakot in that way. Wait a minute. Here you're doing nezek because your birds are eating up the seeds from other parties. How is it that you could establish a chazakot? Rav Mari Amar B'Kutra, Rav Zvid Amar B'Beit HaKisei. This is what we had said above Rav Ashi, that's not completely true. That's only partially true. It's only when there is heavy duty types of nezek that we say this, but not in the cases where it's small amount of nezek. In those instances, we do say you can establish a chazaka for a nizakim, and that's what we said. It was true only by smoke or the Beit HaKisei, whether either it was a very big issue or a persistent issue. Now, the next Mishnah says, Nipul animtza b'toch 50 amah. If you find a young bird that is within 50 amot of the dovecote or the bird's nest, hayu shabala shuvach. He belongs to the individual who owns that dovecote. If it's outside of the 50 amah radius from there, it belongs to the individual who found it. Nimsa ben shtesh shovchot. You find it in between two different dove coats. Karov lezeh shelo. Karov lezeh shelo. It's all about who it's more approximate to. The bird is found closer to one dove coat, it belongs to him. It's found closer to the other dove coat, it belongs to the other party. Mechza, mechza. If it's 50-50, meaning it's exactly in between the two dove coats, shnehem yachloku, then they will split it, because then it's mamona mutal b'safek. And even here, the chachamim would agree, since no one is mukzak in the davar, we assume that even the rabbanim will agree that you split the object over here. Now, a number of points to make here with regards to the Mishnah, the first of which is that this Mishnah really doesn't belong in our Perek or in our Masechta, because it's really talking about Aveda, and belongs in Baba Metzia. It's brought here because of the principle of 50 Amot from the dovecote, which we already mentioned in the previous Mishnah, which is occurring over here, and this 50 Amot distance is significant with regards to birds. The second thing that the Baal Tosafot point out is that we do have a Machlok at other places in Shas between Rav and Shmuel, whether we are hochim achar harov b'mamon. Do we go after the majority when it comes to monetary matters? The assumption of this Mishnah is that the bird is found more than 50 amot away from the dovecote. We assume the bird got there me'alma, from somewhere else in the world. And therefore, since al harov, it doesn't belong to someone or it is hefker, we do not know who it belongs to. That's why you're allowed to pick it up and keep it as an aveda. But that would assume that hochim acharov v'mamon. So Tosfo points out over here that even according to the one who says normally, we do not go after the majority when it comes to monetary matters, that's only in a case when you have opposing that a chazaka. Someone has mukzak, has some sort of ownership or demonstrated connection to the item. And then when you want to use rove to take it away from him, we won't exercise that rove by mamon. On the other hand, over here, where there is no offsetting factor of mukzak, because when we find it over here, there's no reason to believe that it belongs to any party more than anyone else. And therefore, over there, everyone will agree that hochim acharov by mamon. And even though we find in other instances where, for instance, in a city which is rov goyim, that the chachamim still made you do hachraza and announce an aveda that you found, but that is against what we just said. Because based on that, there's nobody who's mukzak in the davar. Given the fact that it's rov goyim in the city, you shouldn't have to announce it. So Tosfot says, that's a takanat chachamim, a special takanat chachamim, in order to accomplish the mitzvah of Shabbat Aveda. Therefore, they make you do a hachraza, despite the fact that halachically there is no obligation to make such a hachraza. Or, based on the fact that if it was Israel who lost it, and it had simanim, then he would not be miyayesh from it, he wouldn't have yeyush on it, and therefore you wouldn't be able to possess the item. So therefore, we make you announce and do the achraza so that you can match it up with the party if someone didn't have yayush on it. And that's why we make you do achraza in those situations. So Tosfot comes to the conclusion that we do pass in hochim achar harov by mamon as long as there's no offsetting chazaka over there. Now, Rabbi Chanina makes a statement here, which is going to be the premise for the Gemara over the next little while, which is Amar Rabbi Chanina, rov bikarov. If I have two opposing claims or forces, one is rov, that the majority dictates that I go in one direction. Vikarov, and the proximity of the item to an object, dictates that I go in the other direction. Hochim achara rov. Rov is always koveya. It's a stronger form of evidence by which I will make decisions. Therefore, if I have a rov, that will dictate over a karov situation. Va'afagav, and even though deruba doraita, the fact that we go after a robe is a din doraita, which is the pasuk of acharei rabim latot. And the fact that vekurva doraita, the fact that something is proximate gives you evidence to dictate the outcome of a situation is also minatorah, based on the parsha of Egla Arufa, where we say there that the city, va'ir ashkrova, the city that is closest to the corpse that we find, will be responsible for taking care of the situation. Even though we find that both of them have manifestations, midoraita, afilu hachi, despite that fact, ruba adif, ruba governs in these situations. Basically, what he's saying is that rov is a koveya that has more power than the medium of karov. In both these situations, we're doing one of two things. We don't have strict evidence to determine what the outcome of the case should be. So now we're relying on other types of evidence. The evidence could be rov, that the majority would dictate in one direction. The evidence could be karov. And what he's saying is that the evidence of rov is stronger than karov. Whether that's because how we view rov, does it rov rubo kikulo? Then we have a rov, then we demonstrate it's almost as if we're certain because it is kikulo. It's almost as if we're saying that it's 100% this way? Or is it whether because Rov as a means of evidence is just a stronger way to make decisions than Karov? It's a more effective piece of evidence. And that's why Rov would dictate over Karov. But for one of those reasons, Rabbi Hanin over here says that Rov trumps Karov in these situations. Tosfot over here asks a very fundamental question as to Rabbi Hanin's position, which is, Rabbi Hanin is not teaching us a chiddush. This is already something we know from a Mishnah. The Mishnah, what's called Teisha Chaniyot. When I have 9 butcher shops in the city that are kosher, and I have 1 butcher shop that's non-kosher, and then I find a piece of meat out, and even though it's closest, this piece of meat, to the non-kosher butcher shop, nevertheless, I still say that a la rov, it's considered to be kosher, and the meat that's there is kosher. So you see already that the Mishnah itself dictates that rov trumps karov. So those that want to say that you could have explained the Mishnah in a case or a situation where it wasn't karov, and therefore it wouldn't give you that information, but the Balei Tosafot bring an additional statement from the Ri that says, V'nira the Ri, the Rabbi Hanina Atal Yashminan, Dafilu Bekurva Demuchach. Even when the karov, or the evidence of the karov, is obvious. Sometimes something is closer, but being closer in and of itself, it doesn't really give you any more evidence. But there are other times where the proximity of the item to whatever object you're measuring against, that proximity is a very strong proof, or would be strong evidence to the fact that there is a connection between this item and the item that you're trying to connect it with. Even in a case of karov de mukach, azlin and bataruba, we still go after a rov. And that's the chiddush of Rabbi Hanin over here. Whereas by the butcher shops, the proximity of the meat to the butcher shop doesn't necessarily connect it directly to that butcher shop, because it's just as plausible that somebody else walking by dropped the meat from one of the other butcher shops. So karov is a piece of evidence, but it's not the strongest piece of evidence. Despite that fact, in the Mishnah we say rov is dictating. In our case, what Rabbi Hanin is adding is that even when the karov is giving you information that makes it almost closer to certainty that it's connected to the original item. So for instance here, where you have the birds would be within 50 amot of the dovecot, that'd be strong evidence of the fact that there is a connection between them. Despite the fact, rov still dictates in those situations. And that's what the Balei Tosafot say, that even Bekurva de Muchach, Rabbi Hanina says that rov governs, and that's the chiddush that he's bringing to us over here. Now the Gemara says, Meitiv Rabbi Zeira. Rabbi Zeira challenges Rabbi Hanina's position. Ba'ir akrova ela chalal. It says by the Egla Rufa that we have to look at the city that is closest to the corpse. Ba'avagav de'ika achrite. Even if there are other cities that are there, the nefisha mina, that are bigger than it. So in that case, we're looking at proximity being the dictating factor, despite the fact that there might be bigger cities that are further away. Bigger cities would dictate that the rov, ala rov, it would have come from the bigger city. Despite that fact, we're still saying that karov dictates. Now, Rabbi Zeira's question leads some Rishonim to believe that there's a fundamental machloket here between Rabbi Zeira and Rabbi Hanina. That Rabbi Hanina believes when you have any competition between rov and karov, rov dictates. On the other hand, Rabbi Zeira is in the opposite position when it comes to rov and karov. Karov will dictate. But the Rashba says this, and many people quote the Rashba in this context, that Rabbi Zeira's question is simply that. It's a question on Rabbi Hanina's position. It's not establishing a position of Rabbi Zeira. Rabbi Zeira is not dictating or saying what his position is or staking out a position. He's simply just questioning Rabbi Hanina's position in order to clarify what exactly the situation is, or whether his statement is actually true, but not coming to give an opposing view to Rabbi Hanina. And this is where Tosfot continues to further his position with regards to explaining Rabbi Hanina as being unique, and that he says that rov dictates over kiruv de muchach, because over here you have a kirva de muchach. And that's what he's saying. From the Mishnah about Teisha Chaniyot, you don't have a question from Egla Rufa, because they say it only true that rov dictates when it is something that is karov that's not muchach. But over here we find the corpse closest to that city, that's a kirva de muchach. And Rabbi Hanina, who says that rov still dictates there, that's where Rabbi Zeira asks his question and says, how could it be? The pasuk seems to indicate otherwise. So Gemara answers, Deleka, there is no other city that's bigger in that area. Velezel bata ruba da alma. Well, if that's the case, why don't we just go after the rov of the world? Because in this situation, the killers could have come from any location in the world. Why are you saying that we go after the Karov, which is the closest or proximate city? Say it should go after the Rove, which is the majority of the people in the world, are not from this city. Yoshevet Ben Harim. It's a case where this city or the cities that are nearby are isolated in general. And so Rashi says over here that Yoshevet Ben Harim, Shein Derech Rutzchim Lavo, Mimkomot Acherim Lekan. Killers don't come from other places. In all likelihood, the killers came from this city because of the isolation of this city. The Rabbeinu Gershom says, people don't traverse or don't go in that area, and therefore you can't make a claim of Ruba da'alma because there aren't other people that go into this area given its isolation. And so therefore there's no issue of Ruba da'alma over here. And that then narrows the scope of the case of where proximity will dictate by Hegel Arufa to cases, first of all, where there are isolated only a certain amount of cities where you could have the people come from. And number two, is it a case where there is no city that is larger in the vicinity that would override the Karov here, according to Rabbi Chanina? There is a machloket in the Rishonim. If there is actually a bigger city over there, what do we do? Many of the Rishonim believe over there there will be no institution of Egel Arufa because we fail in different measures. It's not the city that's closest, but we can't dictate to the city that's closest to do the Egel Arufa because there's a bigger city. And therefore, nobody will do it. On the other hand, the Rambam brings that the halacha is that we do follow the bigger city, and the bigger city will have to bring the Egel Arufa. Tosfot himself poses a question of similar nature over here with regards to a case where the closest city does not have a Beit Din in it. And when the closest city doesn't have a Beit Din, then we move to the next closest city that does have a Beit Din in it. And Tosfot is perplexed by that because he says, then you don't have neither the Rov nor Karov, and we're making that city bring the Egel Arufa. What you have to answer in that case of the Baal Tosafot is that a city without a Beit Din is just not classified as a city. Since it's not classified as a city, it doesn't count in any of these calculations. So now why the sugi is found here is because now we're going to use our Mishnah. Nipul animza betoch hamishim ama. You find a young bird that's within 50 amot of the dovecote. Hariyu shel balo shovach. It belongs to the person who owns that shovach. Vafagav deikachrina denofish mine. Our Mishnah doesn't say that there might not be bigger dovecotes in the area. They just aren't as close. So you see over here, when you have a competition between Rove and Karov, we let Karov dictate. Gemara says, B'deleka, once again, it's a case where there are no bigger shovachim in that area. Iochi, ema seifa. If you say that, then we have to deal with the seifa. Both Rashi and Tosafot point out that over here, the Gemara could have asked, what about Ihochi Ruba Da'alma? The same way it asked by the case of Egel Arufa, it could have asked over here, what about Ruba Da'alma? Rashi says that the Gemara didn't want to do it because it has a better question over here. Other than Baal Tosafot say, it's just a case where there are no other dovecotes or birds' nests within 30 reis, within an area that would have been plausible that the bird could come from. So we've eliminated the possibility of Ruba Da'alma. So Gemara asks instead, what about the latter half of the Mishnah? Once it's outside of 50 amot, harihu shel motzo, then it belongs to whomever has found it. If there's nothing else in the vicinity, the way that Tosafot says it, or we're saying there's nothing else that is bigger or closer to this bird, where else did the bird come from? We have no other choice but to assign it to this person. Now, this is not really a question of Rabbi Chanina, because over here we actually are going after the Rove instead of Karov. We're going after Ruba the Alma versus going after Karov. But if you explain our Mishnah in the way that you did to protect Rabbi Chanina's position, now you run into a problem. Or the question is for Rabbi Zeira, who thinks that we go after the Karov over the Rove. Then over here, why do you get to keep it when you find it? Because you have Karov and Rove. Karov should dictate. Either it's a question on Rabbi Zeira's position that Karov dictates, or it's a question on how we're explaining the Mishnah to defend the position of Rabbi Chanina because it doesn't work out. Mar says, it's a case where it's waddling. These are birds who have yet to take flight. They're too young to fly, but they waddle. Damar mar ukva barchama kol medadeh, im medadeh yuter midyet nunama. That whenever a bird waddles, it doesn't go past 50 amot. As Rashi points out over here, that will answer all of the questions that we've had till now in terms of our Mishnah. And that is, when you were then 50 amot, the reason that we assign it to that dovecote is because the robe doesn't have any impact over here. It's within 50 amot of a certain dovecot. That means it came from there because the bird wouldn't have come from anywhere else. There's nothing else within the 50 amot of this bird, and therefore it must belong to this dovecot. In addition, when it's outside of the 50 amah radius, since the birds don't waddle more than 50 amot, Rashi points out the only way the bird could have gotten there means that it flew there. And then we're mistaken in our assumption that this bird only waddles and doesn't fly. It must have flown there. Once it must have flown there, then it definitely came from the Alma. Then we would go butter rove, and that means it came from all the Alma, and that's why when you find it, you can take it. Tosfot over here asks, why don't we enter also in the variable that it might have been dropped there by somebody who was passing by, which we do in Baba Metzia. We speak about that possibility or plausibility that someone dropped something while they were traveling. So Tosfot says that with birds, that's not such a good assumption, because people are aware of animals or things that are alive. If they dropped it, they would have noticed. And therefore, that's not a good assumption to say that the bird got here by someone dropping it, because that seems to be a very unlikely scenario over here. So then, Bayi Rabbi Yirmiya, Raglo Achat B'toch Nunama, Ro Achat Chutz Michamishim Ama. If he has 1 foot inside the 50 Amot and 1 foot outside the 50 Amot, Mahu, what is the din? And then the Gemara says, Al Da Afkul Rabbi Yirmiya Beit Midrashah. When he asked that question, they threw him out of the Beit Midrash. Rashi says, She'amatriach Aleihem. He was asking these crazy questions about 1 foot here, 1 foot there. It's too much of a detailed and nitpicky type of question. And that's not something that we would answer because it's almost in the realm of ridiculous. And therefore, he was burdening the Beit Midrash with these silly questions. That's kind of the way that Rashi explains it. Tosafot rejects that understanding because he says the Mishnah itself talks about a case where a bird is exactly 50 amot from one dovecot and another dovecot. So the Mishnah or the Gemara doesn't have any problem with that type of exactitude, but rather the Balei Tosafot see the problem in Rabbi Yirmiya's question based on the Rabbeinu Tam is that fact that he's questioning a shi'ur of Chazal. That whenever you have a shi'ur of Chazal, and the Gemara asks another place, says, well, you're telling me if you need 40 sa'a in a mikveh, if it's a little below 40 sa'a, it's not kasher, a little bit above it is kasher. That's right. That's the way shi'urim works. Shi'urim are exact lines. And therefore, since they are exact lines, if you're over the line, that's the end of the shiur. And so there's no room for the question of Rabbi Yirmiya, because otherwise then you undermine or question the whole validity of shirim midrabanan. And when they say 50 amot, then either you're in the whole 50 amot, or once you've stepped over the line, that means you're outside of that realm or outside of the 50 amot that Chazal laid out. And that's the way Tosafot reads the problem in the questioning of Rabbi Yirmiya. Tashma. So now the Gemara continues to ask from our Mishnah on this position of Rabbi Chanina, which is, Nimsa ben shnei shovkot, you find the bird between the two dovecotes, karov lezeh shelo, karov lezeh shelo. If it's closer to one of the two dovecotes, it belongs to them. But it doesn't talk about the size of the dovecotes. It might be that one of the dovecotes is bigger, yet we nevertheless let proximity dictate the outcome over here. It says, Achi ben askinan, what's the case here? Shneim Shavim, that both dovecotes are of equal size. I says, the question that we could have asked before also, which is, Lezel Batar Ruba the Alma. Why don't we go after the majority of the world? I says, Hakamai Skinan, Bishvil Shokramim. It's a case where we're dealing with a pathway through the vineyard. Dimi Ita Dimi Alma Ati. Since, if it would have come from outside of this location, Kevin Dimindade Lo Matsiati. Since it only waddles and doesn't fly, it would not have come to this location. Because a bird only waddles as far as it can still keep its eye on its nest. If it doesn't keep its eye on its nest, it won't move that far away. So being found on the Shvil Kramim already limits the number of locations from which it could come. And that's why we've now eliminated the Ruba Da'alma, because as Rashi says over here, because of the fact that the Shvil Karamim blocks the view of the bird, and therefore cannot see any other nest, and that limits the scope of where it could have come from. So even though here it's above or further than 50 Amot, we're still going to go by the Karov, and not by the Ruba the Alma, because of the fact that there's a limited number of dovecotes it can see from there, and therefore the Ruba the Alma won't have an impact on it. So both Rashi and Tosafot explain that it's even if the bird makes it beyond the 50 Amah range that it normally has, that's being assisted by the Kramim. But it still is not exposed then or opened up to Ruba the Alma because of the fact that it can't see its nests from there. And therefore, we have to assume that it came from one of the two nests that's proximate. Now then, if you look in the Rabbeinu Gershom, he says, that they were then 100 amot of each other, and therefore the exact middle is 50 amot. So he does not explain the case where the bird has gone beyond the 50 amot. It just is explaining why the only birds that are in play over here are these two dovecotes that are within 100 amot of each other, is because the other dovecotes in the area don't have a visual access to this location. And therefore, you can't go after Ruba de Alma or after other dovecotes because they're not relevant to the situation because of the lack of visibility from the Shvilah Koramim to those other dovecotes. So there are two factors here, according to Rashi and Tosafot, which is, number one, if it was in 50 amot of the dovecotes, then for sure Karov should dictate, and Ruba de Alma is not relevant because of the lack of visibility from there to other dovecotes. But what Tosafot and Rashi add is that even in this situation where it exceeds the 50 amot, that is because of the assistance of the Karamim. But the assistance of the Karamim only makes it that it would still only have come from one of these two dovecotes, because they are the only two dovecotes visible on the Shvilah Karamim from the location where the bird is found. And therefore, again, Ruba de Alma would not dictate over here. Okay, we're going to stop here on the top of Chavdalan Amad Aleph, three lines down.